And as long as I'm Attorney General, the criminal justice system will not be used for partisan political ends.
Good one, Bill Barr. That's funny.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yep.
Yes, I'm stuck in the middle.
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A. Also in Red Bluff and Redding, California, on KFOI, Round Mountains, KKRN, and Eureka's KGOE. In Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, and Eugene's KEPW. In Lancaster, Pennsylvania on WLRI, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU. In Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP. In Grand Rapids on WPRR, in New Orleans on WHIV, Gallup, New Mexico's KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM950, KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe. On the internets, even during pandemics, on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, what used to be Indie Media Weekly, but is now Radio for Humans.
Oh, cool.
How's that?
Neat.
Don't know if I'm allowed to go listen there, though. It's, you know, Radio
for Humans.
FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, Workforce Rising, Deprogrammed Radio, and Detour Talk. Blanketing Planet Earth 5 days a week. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us for another thrilling edition of the Bradcast. About 2 weeks ago, right in the middle of a global pandemic, while many in the media might have been otherwise occupied, the U.S. Department of Justice filed a motion to drop all charges in the long-running prosecution of Donald Trump's first national security advisor and one of his earliest supporters, Lieutenant General Michael Flynn. The move was described by Washington Post at the time as, quote, a stunning reversal that prompted fresh accusations from law enforcement officials and Democrats that the criminal justice system was caving to political pressure from the administration. Flynn had already pleaded guilty 2 different times in 3 different courtrooms to charges of lying to FBI agents about his contacts with Russians prior to Donald Trump's inauguration and failing to disclose that he was serving as an agent of Turkey, a paid agent of Turkey, while serving as the President of the United States National Security Advisor, all very serious crimes, according to multiple Department of Justice filings with the court at the time and in subsequent years. But of course, the Michael Flynn prosecution was one of the original sins of the Trump administration. It was the initial FBI investigation into Flynn's lies about his contacts with Russia that led Donald Trump to ask then FBI Director James Comey to, quote, go easy on Flynn. Comey's apparent refusal to do so led, in part, to Comey's firing. Comey's firing led to the creation of the Robert Mueller special counsel probe into Russia's alleged interference in the 2016 presidential election and the guilty pleas as part of that investigation that the DOJ would eventually win from Michael Flynn, at least until just before his sentencing, when Flynn decided to hire some Fox News attorneys to represent him, challenging the initial probe of Flynn and ultimately following the removal of Trump's first attorney general, Jeff Sessions, the hiring of Trump's new fixer, Attorney General Bill Barr, and an attempt by Flynn to then withdraw his guilty plea entirely. Before the U.S. District Judge Emmett Sullivan could decide on whether Flynn would be allowed to withdraw his guilty plea, the judge had already rejected Flynn's new claims that the FBI and prosecutors had manufactured the case against him. Before that, the DOJ filed a motion to drop all charges against Trump's pal Flynn, who, don't forget, had been fired by Trump himself because, as Trump said at the time, Flynn had lied to Vice President Pence about his conversations with Russians. The DOJ motion 2 weeks ago to drop all charges was filed without the signatures of any of the department's career line prosecutors who had spent years working on the case against Flynn. For some reason, like the line prosecutors who worked years on the case against Trump's other pal, Roger Stone, a few months ago, those prosecutors wanted nothing to do with the department's unprecedented motion to essentially say, never mind, on cases that they had spent years successfully prosecuting. Barr explained the reason for dropping the case against Flynn, or at least trying to, during an interview with former Fox News reporter, now at CBS News, Catherine Herridge.
Does the fact remain that General Flynn lied to federal investigators?
Well, to constitute a false statement, you need two things. One, you need a false statement, a lie, and then it has to be material to a legitimate investigation. But it's on the question of materiality that we feel really that a crime cannot be established here, because there was not, in our view, a legitimate investigation going on. They did not have a basis for a counterintelligence investigation against Flynn at that stage based on a perfectly legitimate and appropriate call he made as a member of the transition. Let me just also say that when he pled, the issue of materiality is related to whether the government has a bona fide investigation going on. And that's information that's really within the control of the government. The individual party would really not have that information. So as new information just became available that has a bearing on whether there was a legitimate investigation, that requires us, our duty, we think, is to dismiss the case.
Tough questioning by Herridge there, eh? The DOJ's unusual motion in the Flynn case did not escape the attention, however, of Judge Sullivan, who, with the DOJ now quite literally partnering with Flynn's own defense team to try and toss all charges against the man who pleaded guilty as charged on two different occasions before a federal judge. That judge hired a former prosecutor and federal judge by the name of John Gleason to argue against the DOJ's motion now in this highly unusual, if not unprecedented, matter. But it won't only be John Gleason arguing against Bill Barr's motion. Bill Barr himself already argued against Bill Barr's motion repeatedly. According to longtime legal investigative journalist Marcy Wheeler of EmptyWheel.net, who actually pays attention to court filings instead of only what officials like Bill Barr say to former Fox News reporters. While the DOJ argued in its May 7 motion that, quote, the government is not persuaded that the January 24, 2017 FBI interview with Flynn, the one in which he lied about his conversations with the Russian ambassador, the government's not persuaded that that was conducted with a legitimate investigative basis and therefore does not believe Mr. Flynn's statements were material, even if untrue. That was the DOJ just 2 weeks ago in May going on to say that they had already obtained the content of the conversation with the Russian ambassador through wiretaps and that in any event, quote, those calls, the ones that Flynn lied about, would not have implicated legitimate counterintelligence interests or somehow exposed Mr. Flynn as beholden to Russia. But that is not what Bill Barr's own DOJ said as recently as January of this year about Flynn's lies back in January of 2017. When they filed a motion in January this year saying, quote, it was material to the FBI's counterintelligence investigation to know the full extent of the defendant's communications with the Russian ambassador and why he lied to the FBI about those communications. They called Flynn's false statements to the FBI, quote, significant, and potential, quote, evidence of links or coordination between the Trump campaign and Russia. which was, of course, at the heart of the FBI's counterintelligence investigation at the time of their interview with Flynn. Again, that was the DOJ this year. In other words, just 4 months ago, near the end of a 3.5-year case, long after Bill Barr had already been put in charge of the DOJ, the DOJ itself argued the exact opposite of what the DOJ would argue just 2 weeks ago in trying to clear Flynn of all charges, as Wheeler expertly explained in a recent post at EmptyWheel.net. Joining us now is Marcy Wheeler, an independent national security and legal journalist who, in addition to her site, Empty Wheel, has contributed to many other publications, including The Intercept, The Guardian, Politico, and The New York Times. Oh, Marcy, welcome back to the broadcast.
Hey, it's been a while. Good to be back.
It has been a while. Glad to have you here. Okay, first, I tried to recap how we got here, because this is sort of the case that kind of kicked off everything else as I see it. It's not just another pal of Trump's who's in trouble, but this case is sort of at the heart of everything that came after, including the firing of Comey, the hiring of Mueller, the firing of Sessions, the hiring of Barr, etc. So it's not easy to sort of summarize all of it quickly. Did I miss any big picture items of note in that recap or get any of the details egregiously wrong there, Marcy?
One detail I want to correct is that Flynn stopped working for Turkey, or at least the public record says he stopped working for Turkey mid-September, September 15 or 16, 2016. Mm-hmm. And it was September 17th when Trump officially named him his national security advisor. So there wasn't an overlap there, but where there was an overlap, which is important, is that when Flynn attended candidate Trump's first intelligence briefing, this mm-hmm. is a classified briefing,
right,
he was literally on the payroll of Turkey.
Gotcha. So he wasn't while he was in the White House, but had he already disclosed the fact that he was on the payroll for Turkey when he then served in the White House, as far as you know?
No, he, in fact, did not fully disclose his relationship to Turkey until he pled guilty in 2017. He filed a FARA filing, what's called a FARA filing, in March of 2017, and said, yeah, I was working for maybe what benefited Turkey. But one of the things he pled guilty to December 1, 2017, is that he lied in that filing, in particular by hiding the fact that he knew all along mm-hmm. he was actually working for Turkey.
And he actually made that filing to sort of help himself off the hook. It was after the DOJ had figured this out, figured out that he had not disclosed that he was a foreign agent. So they sort of did him a favor by saying, okay, you can file it. Retroactively, and we'll overlook that one for now. Do I understand that right?
Yeah, I mean, that's what happens. And then when you file retroactively, you have to get things right. Mm-hmm. And as I said, the Turkey thing was not correct in the ultimate filing. One that was even more kind of crazy is that he said along the way that he had written an op-ed that was published on Election Day as part of his activities on the Trump campaign. Mm-hmm. He said he was doing it to up Trump's credibility on counterterrorism issues. Mm-hmm. He didn't write the op-ed. He didn't know what it said before it was sent to him. He just slapped his name on and was paid $500,000.
It was sent to him by somebody in Turkey, and he added his name to it and published it, and that was that?
No, his partner drafted it.
Okay.
But he didn't write it, you know, and his partner drafted it, and therefore not somebody tied to the campaign.
So more reverse engineered lies, essentially, from Flynn.
Yeah, I mean, here's the thing is, like, it's not, a lot of people are like, oh, this is just a lobbying thing. And sure, it's just a lobbying thing, except that it's one thing for Paul Manafort to do it. But Paul Manafort was hiding his lobbying relationship much earlier,
mm-hmm.
not while he was working on the campaign. But it's another thing for the top national security advisor
right.
of the president to first be actively working for Turkey while you're being the top national security advisor for the candidate. But
mm-hmm.
also, I mean, there were conversations that Flynn was having before the inauguration where Turkey was a key player.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that it was not public that he had this prior relationship with Turkey made that really problematic. It made it problematic. I mean, because he was hiding it. He
yeah.
was hiding it from the public, but Turkey knew it.
Right.
I mean, he was working for top ministers of Turkey. It wasn't like, you know, some guy from a Turkish market came along and slipped mm-hmm. him some 50s. He was working for two top ministers in the Turkish government. Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, just sort of underscores how important all of this actually is, and that he was open to blackmail because Turkey knew that he was being paid and the Trump campaigns supposedly didn't and all of that. These are very serious charges, just as Bill Barr's DOJ made clear in earlier filings. Now, Barr did claim that the DOJ reviewed the case and they found newly discovered and disclosed information that led them to changing their mind about Flynn's prosecution.
FBI has already blown that out of the water. As you said, twice after, depending on how you argue it, at least twice after Bill Barr became Attorney General, uh-huh. DOJ represented to Emmett Sullivan, to the judge in this case, these were material lies, it was a legitimate prosecution. They made a very vigorous case for that in that January filing that you described. It was his sentencing memorandum, mm-hmm. which, by the way, is still pending.
Right.
So it's not just that Bill Barr's DOJ has in the past said these were material lies in a legitimate investigation. It's that there is a motion still pending before Sullivan as we speak mm-hmm. that says these were serious lies in a legitimate investigation, sitting there in the docket right next to the one that says this wasn't a legitimate investigation and therefore it wasn't material. Now, yes, DOJ claimed there's new information. Mm-hmm. They did not submit a filing. Normally, when you claim something like that, you have to submit some kind of declaration, and they didn't. Mm-hmm. And the reason they didn't is because while the actual documents were new to Flynn, assuming somebody in Congress who had told him about them hadn't slipped it to him on the side, the information wasn't new. The information has been public since March of 2018 because it showed up in the House Intelligence Committee's Russia investigation report. Mm-hmm. But it hasn't been new to DOJ. I mean, all of the prosecutors involved in this knew it. The same materials got shared with the Inspector General and reviewed before a December 2019 report that didn't mention them. They've been shared to John Durham. He hasn't done anything with them criminally. And today, Sidney Powell, Flynn's lawyers, filed what's called a petition for a writ of mandamus, mm-hmm. which is basically going to a judge's boss and asking them to override the judge. They're claiming that Sullivan has taken some action that has hurt their client, and therefore the D.C. Circuit has to come in and override him. And what's interesting in that petition is they claim over and over again that this was Brady material, that what Flynn obtained was Brady material. Even DOJ is not claiming that. So
is the material that we're talking about here, is that those notes that we saw where the FBI agents are sort of talking about what do we want to ask Flynn during this interview? What are we trying to get from him, even though we already have the contents of the phone call with the Russian ambassador because that was wiretapped? Are we trying to get him fired? Or are we trying to get more information? Is that the newly discovered and disclosed information that Barr is talking about here?
There are two things. Three things. There is a memo that was drafted but never filed closing the investigation into Sullivan. It's pretty meaningless. And again, mm-hmm. the fact that FBI almost closed the investigation into Flynn before they discovered these conversations between him and Kislyak has been public since March of 2018. Mm-hmm. So there's that. But in the motion to dismiss that you discussed, DOJ concedes that it was never filed and therefore the case was never closed against him. There are notes showing that Peter Strzok and Lisa Page responded to discovering that there was a case still open with some expression of happiness that they didn't have to do the bureaucratic paperwork of opening a new case against him.
Those were the FBI agents and their text messages to each other.
Right, and okay. We know the DOJ IG reviewed all of their text messages and in several reviews did not find these pertinent. So, you know, again, it isn't just the prosecutors who have reviewed this. It's also outside reviewers. And then finally, as you said, there were notes taken the day of the interview with Flynn. The most important part of the notes, which you don't hear about on Fox News, is that the head of counterintelligence basically said, the point of doing this interview with Mike Flynn, against whom we have an open, what's called 18 U.S.C. 951, which is a foreign, it's not a lobbying case. It's more of a, are you secretly working for foreign government case. It's what he would have been charged with on the Turkish side had he not pled guilty. But,
And they didn't include that Turkish charge as a favor to him because he did plead guilty and was willing to cooperate in it initially in the case.
Correct.
Right.
Both his attorneys and the prosecution agree that he was facing up to 15 years had he not pled guilty. His original attorneys, now his current attorneys, you know, whatever. Let's not get into that. But
okay.
So the important thing is, those notes and several other contemporaneous records make it clear that the reason they did the interview was to find out whether Flynn was hiding his relationship with Russia. In other words, if they went and asked him, hey, did you call up Russia and say, don't worry about the sanctions, would he say, yes, I did, in which case then it becomes the normal act of a national security advisor calling up his foreign counterparts in the transition period. But he didn't do that. He lied about it. And he lied about it after, and this is the other important part about the notes that you won't hear about on Fox News. The point about the notes is they were saying, we want to figure out whether this guy is secretly working for Russia. Yeah. But what is the actual outcome we're looking for? I mean, what happens if he lies? What happens if he admits it? Then what? And so those are the notes that people find so egregious, because they said, if he admits it, is that a Logan Act? If he doesn't, if he lies, does he get fired? And it's, you know, it one of the reasons it would not normally be Brady is because it was deliberative. It doesn't actually track what they did in the interview. And so a defendant can't use it to say, this is what you did in the interview. But what came out of that discussion was that the agents who did interview Flynn agreed that they weren't going to show him the transcript, but they were going to quote his own language back to him. And if you read the 302 closely, you can see that they did that. And one time when they did that, he even said, oh, yeah, thank you for reminding me. But every single time they did that with Russia, he continued to lie.
So it seems like that that Fox News is flipping out about seems like a rather routine conversation amongst these agents as far as how they're going to pursue this case or how they're going to pursue this particular interview. So they, you know, they have their ducks in a row. It doesn't seem to be particularly egregious. How does the DOJ then attempt to justify their own flip-flops in these court filings, arguing one thing just, you know, months ago, that Flynn, the interview with Flynn where he lied, was material to the counterintel investigation, and now claiming that it was not? Do they even attempt to justify it?
Well, they do by claiming these are new documents.
But they're not.
As I said, they're not. No, they are not.
Okay.
They are newly in the possession of Mike Flynn. But and one of the important things about Flynn is that when he pled guilty, the first time he said, I am not going to get any discovery I might otherwise have gotten. Now, in Judge Sullivan's courtroom, you do get that discovery. And so he was asking for Brady, and Flynn's lawyers were like, give us more Brady, give us more Brady. But the fact of the matter is that Flynn, in 2017, December 1, 2017, find away his rights to get any of this. And then on December 18th, 2018, when he pled guilty the second time, and that was the first time in front of Judge Sullivan, Sullivan asked him, do you have any concerns about Brady? Do you have any concerns about the circumstances of your interview? And he said, under oath, nope. So he's find a way.
And, just to be clear, because you referenced it a few times, Brady is, explain Brady very quickly.
Brady just says that you get exculpatory evidence from the government at a certain point of time in a proceeding. You don't get it if you plead guilty, and you sure as heck don't get it before you plead guilty. And so there was never a time in this proceeding where the existing precedent says he was entitled to it.
Got it.
In Judge Sullivan's courtroom, Sullivan says you have to get Brady because of what happened to Ted Stevens in his courtroom. But that is Sullivan's prerogative. There is no precedent that Flynn can point to and say he is entitled to these documents. And again, that still doesn't explain why DOJ flip-flopped, because DOJ had these documents. And
right.
So one of the things that may happen out of this is that you can't, as the same party, stand before a court and say, I think 2 plus 2 is 4, and then the next day come in and say, I think 2 plus 2 is 17. And that's effectively what DOJ has done. I mean, mm-hmm. even there's even institutional continuity between Rod Rosenstein, acting attorney general, mm-hmm. his approval of this prosecution, mm-hmm. and Attorney General Bill Barr today. I mm-hmm. mean, they're still the same institution. But given that Bill Barr's DOJ said, as you noted, in January, this was material to a serious and legitimate investigation, and now he's saying this was not material because the investigation was not legitimate, he has effectively done just that. And that January filing, importantly, Sullivan twice gave DOJ extensions just to make sure they could get all of the approvals they needed. So they had represented to Sullivan, uh-huh. this is Bill Barr speaking effectively, in January 2020, where it said material to a serious legitimate investigation.
Uh-huh.
And then, you know, May 7th, 2020, Bill Barr comes in and says, I've changed my mind.
Never mind. Please ignore what we told you before. But they can't actually do that, right? They have to actually demonstrate some sort of a legit basis for filing new documents that contradict old ones. In other words, it's not unheard of to change a position on this or that. But they have to explain that to the judge, why they're arguing something different today than they were just days or months ago in this case.
And they have offered an explanation that FBI, in a public statement, has already contradicted.
Now, it seems like Bill Barr is very good, obviously, at gaslighting the American media with his various very serious smoke and mirrors claims. But like you, Judge Sullivan, I suspect Marcy Wheeler, has actually read all of the motions leading up to this. He knows better, does he not? And does he then have a basis for simply denying the DOJ motion and going ahead with the otherwise planned sentencing of Flynn, who, after all, pleaded guilty as charged twice already? If he reads these documents, is he allowed to just go ahead and do that? Say, no, you guys changed your argument. You didn't give a basis for that change. I'm denying it. I'm going ahead with the sentencing.
Well, he could have done that. Instead, he's appointed an amicus, as you said, Judge Gleason.
Right.
And so he wants to create a record that will protect his decision if and when he does dismiss, if and when he does mm-hmm. reject DOJ's motion to dismiss mm-hmm. and move to sentencing, which is also active before him. I mm-hmm. mean, there are all these decisions. And then, importantly, there's the issue of perjury. Mike Flynn has made a series of materially inconsistent sworn statements, not just before Judge Sullivan. Mm-hmm. So what he said at the plea allocution December 2018 is radically different from what he said in a sworn declaration submitted in January of this year. But he's also, for example, made representations before the grand jury that conflict with some things he said in his motion to withdraw. He's some things he said in front of Judge Contreras, the first judge that he pled guilty to, conflict with what he said in this declaration. And so that's a whole heap of conflicting claims, and that's the other thing that Judge Sullivan did when he appointed Gleason. He said, hey, can you tell me what I do about all this perjury going on in my court?
And if he finds out that Gleason argues and Sullivan accepts that, in fact, Flynn did commit perjury, is the judge able to slap him with some sort of perjury charges? Or is this something that we would then need the DOJ to actually prosecute, and we know they're not going to prosecute it?
Well, he framed it in terms of criminal contempt for perjury.
Which a judge can do on their own, essentially slap them with a penalty of some sort for committing a contempt of court.
Right. And he can certainly do that with the conflicting statements before Sullivan. It would be harder for him to add a count of perjury for lying to the grand jury, which, again, is consistent with what Flynn's case is. But if he were to refer perjury to DOJ and they refused to prosecute it, then he could appoint his own prosecutor, and we could be here forever. I mean, ultimately, look, where this is headed one way or another, I mean, unless the Supreme Court intervenes and says Judge Sullivan is a meanie and we are going to do something. I mean, it would be to intervene, particularly in response to the petition for a writ of mandamus submitted Tuesday.
Right.
That one, it would be particularly unreasonable for SCOTUS to rule in favor of Flynn, because all Sullivan did thus far is appoint an amicus.
Right.
And Flynn is saying, oh my gosh, how dare you appoint somebody that my lawyer has applauded you do in the past.
Right.
And so it's actually premature for her to have done this, but I sort of imagine that she's going to try it this time and DOJ is going to come in later and try it if and when Sullivan rejects the motion to dismiss.
So
one of the things that Flynn is trying to do is it's clear that Sullivan wants more discovery. Sullivan has a right to say, tell me what documents were new. We know none of them were. Sullivan has a right to call the prosecutors and say, tell me what you advised with respect to this decision. We know that they didn't support it. Sullivan has the right. Sullivan may well even ask for the actual transcripts of the calls between Flynn and Sergei Kislyak. He had asked for them in the wake of the publication of the Mueller report, and DOJ said, we're not relying on these transcripts for this guilty plea in front of us, so you can't have them. But in that motion to dismiss, they do rely on it. They cite something else entirely, but they say the transcript is perfectly reasonable. So now that they've raised that in Sullivan's court, Sullivan is perfectly within his right to say, you have to give me the transcript so I can see whether it was a normal call.
Yeah, and Judge Sullivan has been very concerned about, throughout this process, he's been very concerned, it seems, about the crimes themselves at the heart of this. If I recall, he was the one who had asked a prosecutor some time ago, is this something that, you know, had he not pleaded guilty, that he could actually be tried for treason here? So Judge Sullivan seems to have a record of being concerned about the actual crime at the heart of all of this. Marcy, I've got to get out here, and I want to hit two quick questions. One, can Judge Sullivan actually hold the DOJ somehow in contempt if he finds out that this was all a political basis to toss out these charges, that there was no legitimate legal basis for doing so?
Well, that's what Judge Sullivan did in the Ted Stevens case. So yes, I mean, he can go after DOJ for lying in his courtroom as well.
That would be fun. And the other question I have, Marzi, your article on this ostensibly was a message to the media, which like to cover both sides of issues, as if both sides always have a point of view worth looking at. But here, you're arguing that to cover both sides of this case, the media have to cover both sides of the argument being made by the one side in this case, the Department of Justice. Have the corporate media been doing so adequately since your coverage on this?
No, not at all. I mean, no. And that's the thing. I mean, Bill Barr, every time he talks about this, should be asked whether he, and I am fairly certain he did, whether he was in the loop or whether his immediate reports were in the loop in approving that January 2020 filing, because if he says they were, then he's in a position where, again, 2 + 2 = 4 and 2 + 2 = 17, and that's effectively where he's at right now.
Were you as not surprised as I was not that he chose to interview with Catherine Herridge, the former Fox News reporter over at CBS now?
She's getting a lot of work these days. She, before that, had published a bunch of stuff that acting director of national intelligence, Rick Grenell, had basically fed her, and she tried to make something out of it. So she earned that softball, quote-unquote, interview.
Mm. Marcy Wheeler, you can and should check out her work at emptywheel.net on this, and I suspect she'll be on it as the case moves forward. You can also find her on the Twitters at emptywheel. Marcy Wheeler, always great speaking with you. Let's not wait another year before we do it again.
Absolutely.
Thanks, Marcy. Of course, that presumes that there's, you know, some sort of criminal chicanery anytime in the near future that we can have Marcy on to discuss.
And who would possibly think there might be more criminal chicanery coming from the Trump administration?
I don't know. There may not be anything to talk about with Marcy. Anyway, okay, let's take a quick break. Oh, speaking of gaslighting America, yes, that's what apparently Republicans are trying to do right now when it comes to the COVID crisis. Especially down in the Sunshine State, where I don't think it's going to work. Quick break, and we're back with that story. And a little bit later, we got Green News Report coming up with Desi Doyen. I'm Brad Friedman, and this is your Bradcast. Sunshine in the Sunshine State?
Yes.
Don't count on it. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. As Florida starts to reopen at the direction of their Republican governor and Trump pal, Ron DeSantis, the architect and manager of Florida's COVID-19 dashboard announced she has been removed from her position. Florida Today reports. Today, Rebecca Jones said in an email to CBS 12 News that her removal was, quote, not voluntary, and that she was removed from her position because she was ordered to censor some data. But she refused to, quote, manually change data to drum up support for the plan to reopen. Jones made the announcement initially on May 5 in a farewell email to researchers and other members of the public who had signed up to receive updates on the data portal, according to Florida Today. Citing, quote, reasons beyond my division's control, Jones said her office is no longer managing the dashboard, is no longer involved in publication, is no longer fixing errors or answering questions, quote, in any shape or form. She warned that she does not know when the new teams, what the new team's intentions are for data access, including what data they are now restricting on the site. She wrote, I understand, appreciate, and even share your concern about all the dramatic changes that have occurred and those that are yet to come. As a word of caution, she wrote, I would not expect the new team to continue the same level of accessibility and transparency that I made central to the process during the first 2 months. After all, she said, my commitment to both is largely, arguably entirely, the reason I am no longer managing it. Wow. Florida's COVID-19 dashboard was created by a team of Florida Department of Health data scientists and public health officers who were led by Jones. They were praised by White House officials for the site's accessibility, according to the Florida Daily. But over the last few weeks, that would have been largely in the weeks since Jones's farewell on May 5. The site has, quote, crashed and went offline. Data disappeared with no explanation, and access to the underlying data sheets became difficult. Jones told CBS 12 News that since she has been removed, the dashboard still has not been fully repaired. Dave Ehrenberg, the state attorney for the 15th Judicial Circuit, which includes Palm Beach County, took to Twitter to respond to this matter, called the allegations, quote, disturbing. Florida Agriculture Commissioner Nikki Fried also responded to the story. She wrote on Twitter, quote, thank you, Rebecca Jones, for not being afraid to speak out. Apparently, the dashboard has been a one-stop shop for researchers, the media, and the public to access and download tables of COVID-19 cases, testing, and death data to analyze freely. It had been widely hailed as a shining example of transparency and accessibility. Researchers who have relied on unobstructed access to underlying raw data said that they interpreted Jones' removal as a clear indication of government censorship of science. Sound familiar, Desi Doyen?
Oh, it totally sounds familiar.
Jennifer Larson, a researcher at the University of Central Florida's Lab X, said, "We would not accept this lack of transparency for any other natural disaster, so why are we willing to accept it here?" Good question. Jones's removal and changes to the dashboard access is especially unusual given that the dashboard was lauded in April, on CBS's Face the Nation by Dr. Deborah Birx, the top official on President Donald Trump's coronavirus task force. She said, if you go to the Florida Public Health website on COVID, they've been able to show their communities cases and tests district by district, county by county, zip code by zip code, said Birx. That's the kind of knowledge and power we need to put into the hands of American people so that they can see where the virus is, where the cases are, and make decisions.
But not anymore.
Yeah, apparently restricting the data, according to UCF's Larson, is the equivalent of cutting off hurricane forecasts as a storm approached. She said it's all of us being denied access to what we know to be safe, adding, it's just absurd that this is being treated differently than any other threat to Floridians. Remember, Rebecca Jones was the head of the health department here, put in charge of doing this job. She was not some third party that was hired off the street or some company that wasn't doing a good job.
She was doing a good job, and I think that that's probably the reason why she was removed from doing that good job.
Professor Ben Sawyer, the director of Lab X at UCF, said he fears the data will become now less available. He said the ability of scientists to help is directly related to how much access we are given to data. He warned that with less raw data, scientists will be able to produce less accurate, less useful work. There's also, quote, the worry that the scientists within government who can access the full data are being actively censored, he said. When Sawyer and Larson tried requesting the previously available underlying raw data, officials with the Department of Health said that because the data are, quote, provisional, no such request would be considered until May, get ready, May of 2021.
Wow.
2021. A year from now, we'll be able to give you the raw data. That's just mind-blowing to me. And as Florida Today notes in their reporting here, the state routinely publishes provisional data, including for infectious diseases such as influenza.
Lying? What?
Well, they weren't lying, but they're in this case, they're saying we can't do it. Provisional data. We need to wait for a year before we'll give it out. But yeah, they give it out all the time for
yes,
other things.
Yes, they do. That to me is lying about it. But you're right. It's not explicitly lying. It's just dissembling a little bit about, hey, this is a special
case. It won't be ready for a year.
It's a global pandemic. What's your rush?
Jay Wolfson, Senior Associate Dean at the University of South Florida's Morsani College of Medicine, said transparent and unfettered access to valid and granular data is central to effective disease control and prevention. I guess if you care about disease control and prevention, which clearly Florida does not. For Wolfson, there are at least two explanations behind restricting the data. One is if the data are, quote, too flawed to be useful. Well, that would make sense. Don't give it out. It's too flawed. There's a problem with it. The other, quote, is that the data reveal information that could be disturbing or contrary to stated narratives. Aha! That sounds like the more reasonable excuse for this. He says either case poses dilemmas for the very way the public's business is conducted. And while economic measures are vitally important to the health of the state, the health of the people of the state ultimately determines the state economic success. Asal Johnson of Stetson University, a professor of public health there, said if we cannot download data, further analysis becomes increasingly difficult. This type of independent research by universities is critical, as it can help taxpayers and residents to make informed decisions regarding their actions. She was also dismayed, this is interesting, that racial and ethnic data has been excluded from Florida's line listing of cases. Such data was reported by medical examiners, but that data table has now been censored by the Department of Health. So the racial and ethnic data, you don't need to know that. As to why the Department of Health is restricting access to data at this time, Johnson could only speculate, quote, to undermine evidence-based decision-making to prioritize the economy. However, she said they are pretending that public health is what has damaged the economy. They are getting it wrong, she said. The economy is damaged because we ignored evidence to protect public health. Adding, they think they can save their own political interests by restricting information. Sawyer at UCF agreed. The worry is that Florida is open, and if that goes poorly, they don't want data available that shows that it is in the process of going poorly. For Larson, if the politics of Governor Ron DeSantis reopening Florida are at play, it is a no-win situation here. She said the virus doesn't really give a damn if you hide its numbers. Which reminded me, Desi Doyen, of what you always say, that science doesn't give a damn if you believe in it or not.
Right.
When we're talking about climate.
That's the neat thing about science. It's true whether you believe it or not.
And speaking of storms approaching, we do have our latest green news coming up in a second. And yes, storms are approaching in the middle of a global pandemic. But why worry? But, you know, I've said from the beginning of this thing, it feels to me, this entire COVID crisis, like a sped up version of climate change.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the science, began becoming clear. And those who did not want to believe the science, you know, they pretended it just didn't exist. And that's what, you know, Donald Trump spent the first, couple of months basically saying, oh, it's going to go away as soon as it warms up in April. By the way, have we gotten to April? Has it warmed up? Has the disease gone away? So pretend it doesn't exist. Then when you have no choice, you acknowledge that it does exist, but it's not that bad. You downplay it.
You bargain that, hey, you know, it's not going to be that. We can do stuff or not. It'll be okay. Don't worry about it.
And then, okay, it exists, but it's too late. We can't really do anything about it. We just got to mitigate. We got to, you know, make the best of it any way we can. There's nothing we can really do to change things. We just have to survive it. All the while, the death toll increases, and then we're in a situation with essentially no possible escape.
Right.
Sounds just like climate change.
Yeah, it's the same circular logic that Republicans bring to everything that is an inconvenient data point that doesn't follow along with their preferred narrative or their preferred ideology. Pretend like the data doesn't exist, deny it first, pretend like it doesn't exist, and then bargain yourself out of it until you just say, oh, can't do anything about it.
Too late.
So sorry, all you dead people.
Yeah, really. I mean, it's exactly what we have seen from climate deniers over the past couple of decades, and it's having the same effect, by the way, with the number of people dying. It's just all happening at hyper speed.
Right.
Which does not bode well for the climate crisis, to be frank.
No.
But all of this, I think, is just one of the lessons that we should all be learning about the climate crisis from the COVID crisis. And you've got a few more such lessons in our GNR coming up next on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't touch that dial. Desi Doyen, a big environmental-related story that came in today, too late for our Green News report,
yep.
But a new analysis published on Tuesday finds that strict lockdowns and scaled-back economic activities contributed to an estimated 17% decline in daily global carbon dioxide emissions compared to averages from last year due to the COVID crisis.
Yeah, it's a really stunning drop, and it is, like we've been saying all along on the Green News Report, it has been a fantastic opportunity to get a glimpse of what the world could be like when we decide to stop polluting with fossil fuels.
Unfortunately, they say that by year's end, they suspect it'll be more like a 7% drop, not enough to have a huge effect, a huge long-term impact on climate change, unless countries return back to business by prioritizing investments and infrastructure to reduce harmful emissions.
Let's try to do that.
Yeah, good luck. Well, what does all of this mean in the effort to fight our climate crisis? We'll try to hold that for another show because there's a lot to discuss there. But we do have a few lessons on it in our latest Green News Report.
The ranges of storm surge could be anywhere between 10 and 15 feet.
Powerful cyclone headed for one of the world's poorest regions amid a pandemic. Man-made climate change leading to more intense hurricanes. Trump EPA refuses to limit toxic chemical in your drinking water. Plus,
physics and chemistry matter, but you can't spin them. They don't negotiate. They're not going to compromise with you. You have to do what they say.
What the COVID crisis should teach us about the climate crisis.
All of those lessons and more straight ahead from bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
Biology just doesn't care. It doesn't care that it's causing a recession. You know, it's not going to back off because it's an election year.
See? That's why you can't trust biology. Too partisan. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, as if things aren't bad enough with the COVID crisis, now we're entering storm season.
Yes, we are. And we're about to see the first major collision of two simultaneous disasters, a destructive cyclone amid the global coronavirus pandemic. As we go to air, Tropical Cyclone Amphan, now a Category 4 equivalent, is forecast to make landfall Wednesday in low-lying Bangladesh and northeast India. Amphan is already the strongest cyclone ever recorded in the Bay of Bengal, with a projected storm surge of 13 to 16 feet, making it an extremely serious threat to one of the world's poorest and most vulnerable populations already struggling with the pandemic.
That's not good.
Nope. Here in the U.S., the first named storm of the Atlantic hurricane season, Tropical Storm Arthur, has formed, not expected to hit the U.S., but Arthur marks the sixth year in a row that a subtropical or tropical storm has developed before the official start to the hurricane season on June 1st. That used to be rare, according to the Weather Channel, but studies indicate it is becoming increasingly common due to ocean warming. U.S. coastal states are now scrambling to prep for mass evacuations and shelters complicated by the pandemic. And now a new study published on Monday finds that man-made global warming is making hurricanes and cyclones stronger. Scientists analyze 40 years of satellite data, finding for the first time a statistically significant global trend, especially in the Atlantic. They found that wind speeds of hurricanes, typhoons, and cyclones have increased almost 10% per decade over the last 40 years, making it much more likely that a given hurricane will intensify into a Category 3, 4, or 5 storm.
So you mean, as we're all worried about the coronavirus crisis, Mother Nature ain't paying attention. She's moving straight ahead with the climate crisis.
Indeed. And these findings are in line with climate scientists' predictions of how hurricanes will respond to global warming. Meanwhile, the Trump Environmental Protection Agency has announced it won't set stronger limits on the toxic chemical perchlorate, a byproduct of rocket fuel that has contaminated groundwater around the country. It causes brain damage in children. The New York Times reports that the Trump EPA acknowledges the damages perchlorate causes, but argues that further regulation is unnecessary.
So when he talked about doing away with regulation, that would be rocket fuel for our economy, apparently what he meant was doing away with regulations that ensured rocket fuel would be in our drinking water?
Yes.
Great.
In politics, presumptive 2020 Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden...
Who?
Joe Biden...
Oh.
has named Democratic Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York to lead his campaign's climate task force, along with former U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry. It's a sign that the Biden campaign is attempting to bridge the divide among Democrats and appeal to progressives and youth voters.
So I guess the progressive and youth voters, that's AOC, not John Kerry.
Right.
Okay.
Biden also pledged on Monday that if elected, he would cancel permits for the controversial Keystone XL pipeline. Finally, CBS's 60 Minutes on Sunday focused on how society might change post-pandemic, as has happened after every previous pandemic in history, noting how fast clean air and water rebounded with less fossil fuel pollution. They asked longtime climate activist Bill McKibben about what the COVID crisis can tell us about the climate crisis.
Maybe we still have a window to take a step back. And if we do, maybe the Earth will meet us halfway.
You're saying flatten another curve.
Flatten another curve. Flatten the carbon curve, too. And if we did that, then people might look back in 50 years at this time and thank us, you know, instead of curse us, because those are the two possibilities.
I'm guessing it's going to be the cursing us part.
But we still have a choice.
But we still have a choice. You're so optimistic.
I try.
For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Don't forget, you can download our reports anytime via Stitcher, TuneIn, Apple, or Google Podcasts. Find us, follow us, and share us planet-wide on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
I won't cry, it'll make things worse. And I'm your curse. I'm your curse. I'm
oh, we are so cursed. Thank you very much, Desi Doyen, and thanks all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program, you can download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. That service and everything else we do at bradblog.com or here on the broadcast is made possible 100% by listener support. Those of you who stop by bradblog.com/donate. To help keep us on your public airwaves 5 days a week. Thank you very much. Thanks also to my guest today, Marcy Wheeler of EmptyWheel.net. If you like, you can drop me email. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the Facebooks and the Twitters, you will find me at TheBradBlog. We'll see you there until we see you here next time tomorrow, I hope. I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.